Flee Social Respectability, Not Being Conformed to the World, was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 10, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
So, two remarks to get started. I think as Christians, we have no choice but to seek to conform our lives to what is true. True in what we believe, valuable in what we value, right in what we choose, and in obedience to God in the way that we live. I don't think that's an option for us. You can't be a genuine, authentic follower of Jesus and have that not be an important element in your life, I think. And that has to do with every area of our life. I first got introduced to that notion when I was in college because I knew that Jesus was a big deal and I believed in him, and I was determined to explore what this Christian thing was. So I started reading people who taught the Bible and theologians and that kind of thing. And I ran into a whole strain of thought within Calvinistic circles that talked about the lordship of Jesus Christ over all of creation and over all of our lives. And the point that they kept stressing, especially in the academy, in the university, and in the intellectual disciplines that you were training yourself in the university, that there was no discipline that shouldn't be brought into submission to Jesus. So what they meant by that is you should think like a Christian. There's a book called Thinking Christianly that echoed this theme that we read years and years and years ago, that if you're studying mathematics, you need to think Christianly in the way you study mathematics. If you're studying sociology, you need to think Christianly in the way you study sociology. If you're studying psychology, you need to think Christianly in the way that you study psychology, and right on down the line. But the main point is, and this goes way back to the Prime Minister of Holland, Kuyper, who really first mainstreamed this idea, that we need to make all of life, bring all of life into conformity with and into obedience to the truth revealed by Jesus. Now, if we were to get into that, I'd have some problems with their perspective, and I'm not sure that their perspective is exactly what the Bible is really getting at. But as far as it goes, I think they're absolutely right. Every area of our life needs to be brought into subjection to the truth that Jesus revealed. Now, it's true, I think, and we have explored that in the first eight chapters of the book of Romans, it's true that somebody's status as a child of God is not determined by whether they get their doctrine right. And not just your theological doctrine, but your sociology and your psychology and your economics and your history or anything else. We're going to make mistakes as human beings. We're going to get some things wrong. And does that disqualify us from being children of God? Absolutely not. And that's what we explored at some length in our discussion of the early part of Romans, is that what makes us a child of God is our inwardness. It's our heart, it's our spirit, it's our inside orientation toward the Creator. We are open and receptive to Him and desiring to serve Him and be obedient to Him and to know Him. We are not hardened and closed and resistant and rebellious against Him. And that inner reality is ultimately the condition that marks us as children of God, not what we believe and what we think and how we understand reality, on the one hand. On the other hand, we have to make a distinction between that and actually being a Christian. And let me explain what I mean. We're often accustomed to facing the question, can someone believe that and be a Christian? That is, can someone who believes in Marxism be a Christian? Can someone who believes in evolution be a Christian? Can someone who believes in liberation theology be a Christian? I mean, those are questions that come up in our thinking. Well, it depends what you mean by that. If we're asking, can someone believe in Marxism and be a child of God? I think the answer to that has to be, well, absolutely yes. How could it not be? I don't have to get my political theory and my economic theory right in order to have a heart that wants to know God and love God. We're all in process. Marxist today is not necessarily a Marxist tomorrow. Believing in evolution today is not necessarily believing in evolution tomorrow. We're all a moving target. And as we journey and as we grow and go through this process of developing our understanding of reality, we're going to change. But you can't measure whether or not I'm an authentic and bona fide child of God who's going to receive eternal life based on a snapshot of my life right now and what it is I believe and what it is I think and what it is, how I understand reality. But if the question is not, am I a child of God and going to receive eternal life? If the question is, can I be a Marxist and have my thinking conform to what Jesus came into the world to reveal? Then I think I can just as confidently say, well, no, absolutely not. Because everything that Marx's theory was based on is antithetical at its foundation, at its roots, to everything that we know from what Jesus came into the world to reveal. So the question then becomes, what's the relationship between being a child of God and being a Christian in the sense of having my thought and my beliefs and my values conform to what Jesus the Christ actually came into the world to teach us? What's the relationship between the two? Well, there are a lot of people who are children of God who are not really yet Christians. We may be saved without being a Christian, but everybody who's a child of God is called to become a Christian. In fact, I don't see how it's possible to maintain that I am a child of God if I'm not open to repenting of my bad political theory and repenting of my bad economics theory and repenting of my bad view of biology and evolution and whatever. I need to be always open to what it is that's true and allow that truth to inform me and teach me and lead me to repent and bring my understanding better and better in conformity with actual reality and what's actually true. Any of us who can stop and say, I don't want to think anymore. I don't want to grow anymore. I don't want to change anymore. I'm content to just stay here and think what I think right now. It's difficult to know how that's consistent with actually being a child of God. Now, ultimately, God has to be the judge of that. I'm not the judge of that. You're not the judge of that. You're not answerable to me. You're answerable to the Lord. But I'm just saying, from a biblical perspective, what it means to be a follower of Jesus is to be a child of truth. To be a follower of Jesus is to be on a journey toward reality and an accurate grasp of reality. Well, in that regard, that's what I was started to say earlier. I think we live in really, really dark and confused times. Times that are more dark and confused than I've ever known in my lifetime. American culture generally, but even more surprising and more startling to me, American Christian culture is particularly dark. I'm in conversation with a young man in Tennessee who's going to a Southern Baptist college in eastern Tennessee. And in the philosophy department of this college, they have a philosophy professor who calls himself a Christian atheist. I don't even have to know what he means by Christian atheist. And I can guess. I have some pretty good ideas about what he means by that. But whatever he means by that, that's confused. That is truly confused to think that I can be a Christian with a faith that's grounded in and based on the Bible, and yet I can accept, as this person does, the insights of a Richard Dawkins, for example. That's crazy. That's really, really crazy. That same school that embraces a member of the faculty who's a Christian atheist, I'm almost certain that they would kick out somebody who believed in seven-day creation. Now, I don't know. I probably don't believe in seven-day creation the way a seven-day creationist believes in seven-day creation. But I sure know that they're thinking more in the spirit of what I would embrace than a Christian atheist is. That's for sure. And yet the one is tolerated, the other is deemed intolerable at an institution like that. On Christian college campuses, the raging fad these days is open theism, the openness of God theology. I don't think that's right. I think that's antithetical to the whole biblical worldview. Openness of God theology is that God is a really, really nice guy and he feels your pain, but he can't do much about it because he's limited, you know. On those same college campuses, or many of those college campuses, not all of them, but many of them, if you espoused divine election, they would consider you evil for doing so. So openness theology is tolerated, but election, which at least has the advantage of actually being mentioned in the Bible by Paul, is evil. A lot of Christian colleges would out and out reject the whole theory of intelligent design. From my perspective, intelligent design is like a no-brainer. How we understand, how we put all that together, there may be room for debate and discussion, but the fact that reality has the earmarks of intelligent design, I don't know how anybody who takes the Bible seriously can reject that out of hand in principle. And I could go on, but I just for the sake of time, that clock is not right, is it? Okay. I'm going to need a timekeeper. When there's 20 minutes to go, if somebody could let me know, flag me. I'm afraid I'm going to run out of time, so I'm not going to multiply more examples. My point is, Christians in America, in Christian culture, are hopelessly confused these days. So the question I want to talk about is, how can you and I avoid going the way that so many Christians around us are going, where they're being molded and shaped, I would submit, by the world around them and not by the truth, not by the teaching and revelation of the Bible, but by what Paul would call the world. So there's two questions I want to explore. What exactly is the dynamic by which the world shapes us? We don't often talk about that and discuss that, and I want to spend some time looking at that. Is that dynamic the same for every time and place throughout human history, or does it change and vary from culture to culture and from different times in history? Is there a way that it shapes us today that may be different than the way it shaped people 50 years ago? We'll talk about that a little bit. And then secondly, the second question is, how do we resist the shaping, molding forces of the world around us? I think those are critical questions for us these days. And the way Paul puts it, we will get there eventually in Romans. He starts off chapter 12. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. That's what I want to explore, is what's the dynamics of being conformed to this world? Notice its passive voice. It's the world is conforming us, is shaping us, is impinging upon us and making us think the way we think and be who we are. And Paul says, don't do that. Don't be letting that happen. Rather, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So what are those dynamics at work in our world today that make the world shape us and mold us and define us? To get there, I want to look at an example of how it was working in another time and place and culture and go to the book of James. I think the book of James is very instructive. And it wasn't until recently that I realized how relevant it really is. I've always tended to dismiss James because their problems are not my problems. Their situation is not my situation. A lot of good things in James, but it's a different situation. And I think what I want to argue today is it's actually not a different situation at all. We're in exactly the same situation that they were in. The book of James was written to believers, early Jewish believers, probably in Judea and the surrounds of Jerusalem, who they'd become believers, followers of Jesus, believed that Jesus was the Messiah, and they were being subjected to the persecution that you see talked about in the book of Acts. And particularly, it seems to be, by the wealthy landholding Jews, the aristocratic class among them. They were the owners of all the land. And so how did you survive as a Jew in those days? Many Jews had to go and work as day laborers or as hired help to these wealthy landowners who had all the economic power. And you'd work for them and they'd pay you a day's wage. You'd work for them, they'd pay you a day's wage. These landowners were, if they found out that people were a follower of Jesus, one of the things that we know is happening, because James mentions it in the letter, is you would go and work for a landowner, you'd come to the end of the day, and the landowner would refuse to pay you any wages for that day's work, and would rob you of your labor, rob you of your effort. And why? Because you were a stinking believer in Jesus. You contemptible little scum of the earth, you. If you believed in Jesus, you were no good. So he felt perfectly justified in withholding your wages. They were bringing believers in Jesus to court on various charges, probably false charges. But they were bringing them to court, and that was resulting in all kinds of hardship. There's no specific mention of death, but it wouldn't surprise me, as in the case of Stephen, that in some cases even involved death. So the establishment, the powers that be, were using their power to get people falsely charged, convicted, and executed or imprisoned. As a consequence, because of the economic injustice that's going on, these Jesus believers are becoming impoverished. And so in the book of James, you have this rich, poor thing going on. But it's very important that we realize it's not just rich, poor in any given time and place in history. It's rich and poor in first century Judea. And in first century Judea, the rich, poor distinction is the godly and the ungodly. I mean, the poor that he's talking about are not everybody that's poor, but it's these people who are poor because they're being persecuted and being taken advantage of by the godless and ungodly rich people. So let me read a couple of passages here out of James. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. The letter is to the believers who are being taken advantage of. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But he must ask in faith, without any doubting, for the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For that man ought not to expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. But the brother of humble circumstances is to glory in his high position. Now, I want to underline that, because that's basically my appeal today, that we take James' advice here and be as brothers of humble circumstances in the way that I'm going to define later. We need to recognize that our position is the exalted position, and therefore to glory in our exalted position. The brother of humble circumstances is to glory in his high position, and the rich man is to glory in his humiliation, because like flowering grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and its flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. So too the rich man in the midst of his pursuits will fade away. Okay, then he goes on, and then a little later in the letter, he addresses a particular issue that I think is going to be very instructive for us. In chapter 2, he says, "My brethren, do not hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism. For if a man comes into your assembly with a gold ring and dressed in fine clothes, and there also comes in a poor man in dirty clothes, and you pay special attention to the one who is wearing the fine clothes and say, you sit here in a good place, and you say to the poor man, you stand over there or sit down by my footstool, have you not made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil motives? Listen, my beloved brethren, did not God choose the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who love him? But you have dishonored the poor man. Is it not the rich who oppress you and personally drag you into court? Do they not blaspheme the fair name by which you have been called? If, however, you are fulfilling the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing well. But if you show partiality, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. And then he goes on. The thing that's striking about James is the fact that James is responding to a group of believers. These are followers of Jesus, self-acclaimed followers of Jesus, who are doing two things. They are betraying and pitting themselves against fellow believers. They are complicit in the persecution of their fellow believers at times. And then also, they're sucking up to the rich men, showing them favoritism in the synagogue, flattering them, showing deference to them. Oh, please have my seat over here. Come and sit here. While they despise and hold in contempt the poor man who is their fellow believer in Jesus. This rich man doesn't believe in Jesus, but the one who is the brother in Christ and a fellow believer, they hold them in contempt. Okay, so what does James say to these poor, socially disadvantaged believers? He says several things. Most of them are not relevant to my topic today. He talks about the importance of persevering through suffering, very important concept and theme, the importance of really believing the truth of the gospel with an authentic belief and not just saying you believe it, but believe it in a way that actually makes you live out the implications of it. He talks about the importance of not being ruled by worldly desires, very important theme, and the importance of accepting one's suffering and learning contentment, not fighting against one's circumstances, but submitting to the suffering. All those are very important themes in James. But the one thing that I want to highlight here is his other theme is, you are the rich ones. In spite of the fact that everyone around you is saying that rich guy has all the advantage and has all the power and isn't he glorious and isn't he amazing and isn't he worthy of your respect, James is saying, no, you're the ones that are worthy of respect. You are the ones with the exalted position. You're the fortunate ones. You are the lucky ones. They are in the position that is unfortunate and unlucky. So he tells the readers, believe the objective truth about yourselves. Don't allow the world to tell you what to think about yourselves. Take the objective truth about yourselves, that indeed you are rich and exalted, and believe that about yourselves. Don't let the world tell you what to think. And if you believe the objective truth about yourself, then you will not envy the rich man, because there's nothing enviable about his position, and you won't seek to be accepted by them and respected by them, because who are they to withhold respect? What difference does it make what they think about you? They are foolish abominations in the eyes of God. So what does it matter what they think? So you don't need their acceptance, and you don't need their respect if you understand who you are and who they are. You're able to be independent-minded. And then finally, if you know who you are and who your fellow believer is, you won't despise your fellow believer and mistreat him and join the rich power culture in mistreating him. Instead, you will hold him in the respect that is his due as a child of God who has a high and exalted position. So the question, the question is, does that have any relevance to us? And for years, I've just kind of dismissed that because I'm not poor. I'm one of the wealthy people by world standards. I'm doing just fine. So what does this have to do with me? Well, it hasn't translated for me into economic terms, but all of us have felt the scorn and the contempt of the ruling class in our society, the power class in our society. They may not be the wealthy people, but they are the socially powerful. And to the extent that the socially powerful have held us in contempt and scorned us, we are in exactly the position that these poor people were that James is talking to. And what he has to say to them applies directly and immediately to us. In James' time, the wealthy people, landowners, were whistling the tune that everyone else was supposed to dance to. They held all the social power. Now, where did their values and beliefs come from? Probably not generated by the wealthy landowners themselves. It was probably generated by an even more socially powerful class, the rabbis. But the wealthy people in James' time were the enforcers. They were the people that could punish you if you didn't believe what the rabbis said to believe and didn't conform to the values and attitudes that the rabbis said you need to conform to. So they became conduits of the vision of reality that was generated among the rabbinic class and imposed on all the people through this powerful social dynamic of, if you don't conform, there are people amongst us who are going to punish you. And in their case, it was economically punish you. What is it in our day and age? Do we have anything comparable to that? In our day and age, the power that we have held over us is the power of immediately of name calling and labeling on the one hand, but on the other hand, you know, sticks and stones and all that. It's not the name calling itself that is the power. It's the social. It's the power to declare you socially contemptible. And my experience is we face that every day of our lives in one way or the other. I'm gonna cut out some stuff here, but my realization of this starts way back in high school for me. I remember going into high school, and God gifted me, I think, with a very, very important gift. I have never, ever in my life ever believed that I had a ghost of a chance of being cool. And it put me in a really interesting position to be able to observe my culture and observe life and respond to life in a particular way where I really never felt the possibility of social acceptance because I was always kind of a nerd and shy and a social outcast and on the margins of things. I was just sort of on the margins watching. So I never really thought that even if I wanted to try to fit in, that I could, so I didn't really particularly try. So in high school, it became really apparent very quickly that the things that I had learned from my mom and dad and family and church and so on, the things about Christianity really were very uncool. I was an idiot, I was ignorant, I was backward, I was old-fashioned, or just plain not cool to believe that. So I just sitting there watching that, you know, when I went to church or when I listened to my parents, it sounded reasonable, it sounded right, it sounded good, it sounded plausible, sounded compelling on the one hand. On the other hand, nobody at school agreed with me. Everybody at school was telling me the other story. There was kind of a patronizing tolerance of people like me that is, oh yeah, religion has its place. But it doesn't have its place in reality, in real life. No serious person believes what somebody like you believes. Well, college got worse. College was a full-out assault against everything that I believed. What I learned in college is that what I believed was contemptible, what I believed was dangerous, what I believed was idiotic, what I believed was, I mean, you name it, there really wasn't anything going for it except that little pat on the head. But religion can make people better people. So I guess it's kind of okay if you really have to believe it, and if you really want to believe it, there can be some beneficial effects of it. But boy, the really strong and noble people will be good people without religion. And that message came through just loud and clear. And what I noticed as I watched my Christian classmates in college, ideas that would have intuitively resonated with them because of their Christianity and because of their background in the Bible, as those ideas came under attack in the college classroom, little by little they gave up on those beliefs that in my mind were perfectly compatible with what the Bible taught and their biblical worldview, but they would find a way to employ their intelligence to eviscerate those beliefs, to gut them, to evacuate them, so that even if they had the shell of what Christians believe, they really didn't have the substance of it any longer. And at the time, I chalked it up to they're just wanting to be intellectually respectable. But in looking back, I think I hadn't really analyzed it rightly. It wasn't just a lust for intellectual respectability that was driving them. It was really a lust for social acceptance that was driving them. Because if it was just intellectual respectability, you can fortify yourself with that, as I had the opportunity to do. I could sit back and go, you know, I know they all think that this is not intellectually respectable, but I've like thought about it. I've checked it out. I've considered some of the options, and actually it really is intellectually respectable. I mean, even if I'm wrong, I'm not an idiot. And I was able to come to that conclusion just inwardly on my own. So I didn't need to fear being intellectually not respectable because I was convinced that I was. But you can't convince yourself that you are socially accepted when you ain't. That's not something you can deal with internally, because there are very real, palpable, tangible dynamics where the looks, the gestures, the various ways, the insults, the mockery, the contempt that comes your way, you can't help but be victimized by it. You feel it, you see it, and so on. Didn't much change anything for me. I had always been a social outcast, so it really didn't have that much of an effect on me. But for the people who that mattered to, it sucked them right in. And it just, there was somebody out there that was whistling a tune, and I saw all of my friends beginning to dance to that tune. That's exactly, I think, the dynamic that James is talking about. What would possibly make a believer in Jesus in the time of James betray his fellow believer? Turn him in, bear false witness against him, help the guy rip him off and steal him of his wages, whatever it was that they were doing. Why would one believer hold another believer in contempt and mistreat him? Well, because someone was whistling a tune and they dare not do anything but dance to that tune. So the more I think about that, the more I realize American culture have gods out there. There are gods out there that actually shape a quasi-objective reality for us. And that objective reality is some things are cool, some things are acceptable, some things are respectable, and there are other things that aren't. And whether we can articulate it or not, and some of us are probably able to tune into it more keenly than other people, but to the extent that we can tune into it, it becomes intuitively clear to us there are certain boundaries that you have to stay within. And if you stay within those boundaries, you will be socially accepted. If you stray from those boundaries, you're going to be punished. One way or the other, you're going to feel the contempt. You're going to feel the disdain. The message that's going to be sent to you that you're going to start believing about yourself, and that's the punishment, is that you are a contemptible person. So the question is, who are these gods that define what's cool and what's not cool, what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, what's within the bounds and what's outside the bounds? I read an article that just really resonated with me because it kind of took in all that stuff I had experienced from high school through college on and kind of analyzed for me and put into words what I'd been feeling my whole life. It's an article that was published in the American Spectator by a guy named Angelo Codavilla. Codavilla, so I don't know what language it is. He's a professor emeritus of international relations at Boston University. And the article is called America's Ruling Class and the Perils of Revolution. He has a book that I've ordered. I haven't read his book yet. It's on order. But this article just really, really struck me and hit me. His thesis is that indeed America does have now and has had for some time what he calls a ruling class. That there's a ruling class in America. And exactly like the wealthy landowners of first century Judea, this is not his point, this is my point, they whistle the tune that all the rest of us are supposed to dance to. How does it impose its rule? Well, primarily, I would submit, I mean, this is, I'm leaving Codavilla's argument here. This is me speaking. His argument stands alone and is brilliant, I think, from my perspective. But as I think through my whole my experience, how does that ruling class impose its values on us? Namely, through the dynamic that I just described, the name-calling and the labeling. You homophobe, you Islamophobe, you hate-monger, you extremist, you racist, you nut, you quack, you rube, you hick, you redneck. At least they have a large vocabulary. but by attaching that label to someone, you have basically said to them, you are one of the contemptible ones. We hold you in contempt, and you should hold yourself in contempt. It's what stings is the social rejection. Or, for us who are believers, even beyond that, what stings is the moral rebuke. You are actually immoral at the very core of your being, of who you are. And because being moral matters to us as believers, that even stings more than merely social rejection. Okay, so what is this ruling class? How are we to understand this ruling class? It's not a conspiracy. It's not that a group of people who appointed themselves and got into a smoke-filled room and conspired to decide what values are going to be acceptable or not. It's an informal process, but it's an informal process that I think with a little thought we can understand how plausible it is that, of course, a ruling class would develop. Ultimately, of course, there's a divine design behind it. The author of all history is in charge of this, the gods of American culture defining the values for us. And maybe it's true that there's a diabolical design behind it. I don't know. I leave that to people who know more than I do. But granted, there may be larger designs behind it. But at the level at which we live, it's simply a very straightforward social dynamic that puts it in place. We learned in kindergarten, didn't we? And if we didn't learn it in kindergarten, we certainly learned it in middle school, that some people just have the social power to be able to kind of rise to the surface. And as they rise to the surface, they begin to impose on other people their perspectives, and they demand a certain kind of conformity. So every middle school, I think, that I've ever known has a group of people that emerge as the cool kids, and you belong to that group and you're in, and if you don't belong to that group, you're not in. And of course, you'd like to belong to that group. And to the extent that you are consumed by the desire to belong to that group, to that extent, you become servants of their desires and of their values and of their way of looking at the world. They whistle and you dance. So we've seen that in our own life and experience. I think the ruling class emerges because somewhere, somehow, those people who have real innate social power have risen to a position of being able to impose their values on the world. In our day and age, I would argue, those values are godless. In another day and age, they were the Christians who were the ruling class, or religious Christians of one stripe or another, and they were the people who were in positions of power. And they punished the people who didn't believe. So it can go either way, but I'm not talking about then, I'm talking about now. And in our day and age, the ruling class is a class that has imbibed completely, utterly anti-biblical, anti-God values. So notice that whoever these gods are that define the values for American culture, they're not the politicians. They're not the people who nominally have power in our culture. I don't know who they are. I can't point to them. I can't identify them. But it really doesn't matter who they are. Somehow, somewhere, powerful individuals in American history rose to the surface and convinced enough people that if you want to be acceptable to me, you have to reject the values of the Bible and Christianity and God and so forth. And then that takes on a life of its own. There, you really have to make a distinction between the gods who define the values of American culture, who tell you what's cool and acceptable, and then those people who serve those gods. Now, who are the people that serve those gods? It's plain old or ordinary people every day like you and me. And they may be elected to Congress or they may be an electrician. They may be in a position of have a governmental role, or they may have no such role. But we all nonetheless serve the gods of American culture, the ruling class. And how do we do that? Because we feel the threat, the temptation, that if we don't go along, if we don't dance to the tune that's being whistled, I'm going to be punished. So I dare not hesitate to dance. So we say what we're supposed to say, we think what we're supposed to think, we believe what we're supposed to believe, we do what we're supposed to do, because if I don't, I'm going to be cast out. I'll get some name thrown at me that's going to mark the fact that I'm being socially rejected. What all is dictated to us by the ruling class? It tells us what people, what individuals, what public figures, what groups we're supposed to like, and what people and individuals and groups we're supposed to dislike. Who is mainstream and normal and reasonable and sane, and who is nutty and extreme and out of the loop? You know, who are they? Now, we may think that that's, to illustrate my point, we may think that that's just a partisan game. The left wing calls the right wing extremist nuts, and the right wing calls the left wing extremist nuts, and that's just how the game gets played, is that we each call names at each other. But let's do a thought experiment. Imagine me somehow, somewhere, getting on NBC News in an interview, and on NBC News across the nation, I talk about what, let me get this right, that I think Bill Maher is a despicable, morally stunted human being without an ounce of wisdom or clarity. And I say that. And I say that Richard Dawkins has the philosophical sophistication of a banana slug. And I say that on national television. Now, imagine that Barry Lind, the president of Americans for the Separation of Church and State, if you know who that is, calls Rush Limbaugh or Sarah Palin dangerous extremists on NBC News. Now, unless I'm terribly wrong, don't you feel how the difference in how our culture and how our society would listen to me and my claims versus how they would listen to Barry Lind's claims? Barry Lind's claims would be accepted as balanced, reasonable, sane. He's a respectable individual who, from his standpoint, is just simply assessing the way it is. That's just the way it is. But what about Jack Crabtree? Well, of course Bill Maher looks dangerous to him. He's so far out there and extremely religious and Christian and so on. The guy's a nut. And because he's such a nut, you can't take his assessment very seriously. Now, why? Why do we respond that way? And I would respond that way if I was listening to myself. Why would I respond that way? Because I know how I'm supposed to respond to that. It's in the air. It's the objective reality that has been created for us by the gods of American culture. The gods of American culture has told us how to assess the various beliefs and values and perspectives of different individuals and different groups and so on. What an odd phenomenon. But I think it's a reality. I think that's the world that we live in. And unless I'm just dreaming all this up, and I am a nut, I think that's the social force that all of us have impinging on us. The ruling class dictates to us what moral causes are worthy and what are not. So making sure that civil rights are not denied to homosexuals is a really, really classy moral cause. Being against abortion, it's kind of passé, not very interesting, really. Have a cow. Don't get too upset about that one. The ruling class dictates to us not only what to believe, but how to defend my belief. This very belief that I'm supposed to accept and embrace and find compelling, if I'm in need of an argument for it, they'll give me the argument for it too. That's one of the oddest features of modern American culture, is that in those... is how often you hear exactly the same word, exactly the same phrase, exactly the same sentence used in defense of a certain social political position. And it just gets repeated over and over and over again from one person to the next person. Now, is it possible that a one-line slogan could have lurking underneath it an actual valid argument? Yeah, that's possible. But what's odd is, you always hear the slogan, you never hear the argument. Why is that? Because I don't have to give an argument if I'm safe. If I give the orthodox acceptable argument or the orthodox acceptable reason or evidence for my social political position, I don't even have to say any more because I've really basically waved my white flag and said, I'm on your side. You have me on your side. I'm being faithful and loyal to the ruling class. You only have to give an argument if you're going to challenge the ruling class, and even then they won't listen to the argument. Odd situation that we find ourselves in. Boy, I have way too much stuff here. But so as a matter of historical fact, the ruling class in America is hostile to God, it's hostile to Jesus, it's hostile to the gospel, it's hostile to righteousness, it's hostile to godliness. And that those hostile values are constantly, day in and day out, being pressured upon us, not just by the media, although the media is huge, but by everyone we work with, by our neighbors, by everyone we talk to. You simply know that if you cross certain boundaries, you're going to get that look, you're going to get that comment. Somebody is going to send a message to you, you are socially despicable human being. No one in their right mind thinks that or believes that. Well, notice the power that that has on us. So when it comes to shaping, to trying to be the Christian that we are in the process of trying to be, that is, by making my political beliefs and my social beliefs and my economic beliefs and my philosophical beliefs, make everything that I believe line up with and conform to the biblical worldview and to the truth as revealed by Jesus. Do you see what a powerful obstacle that is when you have all these people out there saying, ah, but don't go there, but don't think that, and don't say that, and don't believe that, and least certainly don't say that out loud, because that's not acceptable. Then it's so easy for us as believers, like the believers in the time of James, to go, here, take this seat, sir. Let me flatter you with this seat. You want me to say that I believe this? Okay, I'll say that I believe that. You want me to think that this is important? Then I will think that this is important. Yes, sir, certainly. Because we are kowtowing to people whose destiny is destruction. We are kowtowing to people whose lives are given over to folly and foolishness and evil and godlessness and everything wrong. And I think James' message to us today, if he were in our context talking to us, he'd go, what's with that? What are you doing? Don't you understand who you are? You are the ones who have become enlightened. You are the ones who really get it. You are the ones who really understand. And you are the ones whose destiny is to be citizens in the eternal kingdom of God in the age to come. You're the lucky ones. You're the fortunate ones. You are the noble ones. You are the respectable ones. So what on earth are you doing and going and seeking the approval of the ruling class instead of your God, your Creator? There's only one God. It's the one who created me and who created history and has created a purpose for history. That's the one I need to respect me. He's the one I need to accept me. So James would say, don't you be looking for the acceptance and the respect of all those foolish, abominable rebels that are whistling the tune and demanding that you dance to it. So James is not calling the believers in his time to political rebellion per se. It's not really a political issue in the sense that, you know, he doesn't think that they can change Judean society. He doesn't think they can overthrow Rome. He's not spoiling for that. It's a spiritual issue for him. It's a question of you who are in the midst of your tribulation. Are you going to let the tribulation erode your faith in and respect for your Creator such that you respect the rich landowners even more than you respect your Creator? Or are you going to hold on to your respect for your Creator so much and be so focused on that that you're willing to say, as the ruling class whistles, I'm not going to dance. I don't dance to that tune. There's another tune playing, and I only dance to that tune. So in answer to the question, what is the antidote to this? I think the primary antidote is what Paul talks about in the end of Hebrews. He talks about how Jesus went outside the camp. And what he means by that is that's an allusion to the Old Testament practice of taking the scapegoat outside the camp after the sins have been identified with the scapegoat and he's removed, and various other things in the law where when something is unclean, it must be removed from the camp. And the point that Paul is making in Hebrews is, well, that's what happened to Jesus. The culture of Jesus' time held him to be socially contemptible, and they crucified him, and they mocked him, and they held him in contempt. And Paul tells him in Hebrews at the end, he says, go outside the camp with Jesus. Join him there. That really is what we need to resolve to do, is that we need to resolve, it really doesn't matter whether you hold me in contempt or not. I am going to glory in the contempt that you have for me. It's ironic that the name Christian was originally, as best I can tell, a term of contempt. You know, that it basically means little Christs. And so the opponents of Christianity were calling the believers little Christs to mock them for their hubris and for their self-righteousness and their arrogance and their thinking pretty high of themselves, I think. So it's interesting that I think the Christians embraced that title. What their opponents meant as a term of contempt and disrespect, they accepted as a term of glory. And I think we need to do the same thing today in our own way. Am I a hate monger? You bet. I'm a hate monger in exactly the way that you don't like about me. I am growing in my hate for evil and my love for righteousness. I'm absolutely a hate monger. Are you a narrow-minded bigot? I am narrow. You're absolutely right. I am narrow in my belief that there is one and only one truth, and everything that departs from that is an error. And there is one and only one way to blessing and salvation, and there ain't any more. And you got to find that one, or you're not going to get there. It's incredibly narrow, and I own the title. Yes, I'm absolutely narrow. And we could go right down the line, because all those labels that they sling at us, what they really betray, what they really hate about us, and what they really hate about us is what we really should glory in. So instead of being afraid of their insults and afraid of their contempt and afraid of them shaming us, we should just simply accept, what else can I expect? That's what they did to our master. That's what they did to Jesus, and I can't expect them to treat me in any better way than they did him. Jesus himself said, if they hated the teacher, they're going to hate you, the disciples. And we just need to simply face into that, because if we can face into that, then truly sticks and stones does apply. Their names do not sting, because that really doesn't matter to me if I'm rejected by the world, because to be rejected by the world is to be embraced by my Creator. And that's what I want. I'm a fool if I don't want that. Okay, we don't have a lot of time, but in the few minutes remaining, do you have any comments or questions?
I'm just remembering when I heard you in a debate at some place with a guy who was probably fit all those descriptions in the powerful group, that's how I call them. And I remember you saying something just so surprising after he, I think, was kind of making a lot of assertions about what you believe, or I don't know exactly, but I just remember you saying to him, you'd be surprised how much I agree with you on so many things. And I think, it really disarmed him because you weren't being, it's so hard to know how to talk to people. I really appreciate everything you just said, but it's really hard to know how to, in a sense, I don't want to come across as someone who is self-righteous and hate-mongering and all these things, but and so somewhere in there's a room to say, I agree with you on a lot of stuff. But then, yeah, it's like, what they really hate about me, I have to recognize. And anyway.
So that's a great point. Hopefully you know that I am not afraid to criticize Christianity and Christian culture and what we've done. And I hope it's true. God help me if it's not true, that my criticism of Christianity is not because they're wanting to follow Jesus. I'm not critical of that, and I hope I've never been critical of that. I'm critical of their way of understanding who Jesus is and how what they think is their way of following him. And I think we need to face the criticism of our wrong way of thinking about that. But I hope I would never be critical of Christians being Christians. But all too often, there's a pocket of people in Christianity who sound more like the late night comedians, more like Jon Stewart and Bill Maher, than they do like Luke or Paul or John. You know, that they, because they are dancing to the tune that's being whistled, they think it's kind of cool to be critical of those narrow-minded, self-righteous, bigoted Christians out there. Well, yes, self-righteousness is evil, and bigotry is evil, and there's all kinds of things that Christians evidence that's evil, and it should be criticized, but that's not what they're critical of. And we have to be discerning enough to realize that they may use language that is worthy of criticism, but what's behind their language and what they're really hating is what I glory in. It's the truth that Jesus is the Messiah and that we owe our lives to him.
So sometimes a narrow view is actually really wide.
Exactly.
Like, it's like it almost gets, when you get it narrowed down enough, it really opens it up almost.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah. I mean, now it is true that within certain Christian traditions, we can narrow it down where it really is narrow. Because we're just really not even thinking. We're not reading our Bibles. We're not trying to understand our Bibles. We're just becoming religious dudes who are being religious and stuck in our particular tradition. Because the narrow way is much wider than we know that it is and think that it is.
Yeah.
So that's true.
Yeah. And so, like, a lot of people I know actually see most Christians, or rather, like, the religious institution of Christianity as part of the ruling class. Like, but you were saying that you don't think that Christians are part of the ruling class in this time.
Yeah, not at all. I remember way back in high school, youth leaders who were just doing everything they could to make Jesus cool, right?
Yeah.
Well, they couldn't even convince themselves, right?
Yeah.
Because there's a whole objective reality out here that you have to be answerable to, that tells you whatever else is true, Jesus is not cool.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's true believers that have in any way contributed to making that the objective reality of American culture. It's somebody else out there.
Yeah. So it's kind of sad that that's what a lot of people think Christians are.
Is the ruling class?
Yeah.
Yeah. That frankly, from where I sit, that's bizarre. That is just really a bizarre perspective.
Yeah.
The Jack I know is really humble. And even, I guess, when you say some of this stuff, the part I have a problem with is if a person, how do we know where someone's coming from? Okay, they can say where they're coming from. Somebody who has a very unbiblical viewpoint, whatever it is, political, social, whatever it is, social, anything, that is absolutely, clearly anti-biblical. So the difference, the part of this that bothers me, not just with you, but whether it's bigotry, hate, as a believer, isn't it true that it is our responsibility not to determine whether a person, what direction they in the end are going? I mean, I guess, back up a bit. If somebody says they're not a believer, somehow it stuck with me long ago that they could someday be. And whether or not they are, I don't think they deserve any less love than a believer does. So, and then that's a question I would have about that passage, and I've always wondered about in James. Isn't it true that we need to treat the rich, the poor, the believer, the non-believer, with the same genuine love, no matter what direction they're going? And so in the sense of disagreeing, but separating that with the value of God's magnificent creation and the respect that every human being, I believe, deserves.
Yeah. Now, I'm trying to connect your question with what I said. Where did you feel attention?
Well, you're not talking in that way, right? I mean, with what you were saying, you were talking more in a very strong belief and encouraging believers, I think you're encouraging us to not be afraid of the social ruling, but I guess part of me also would argue that there may be more than one social ruling. I mean, like, say politically, either side is very critical toward the other extreme.
Yeah, I don't think it's not a partisan thing. That's one of the things that one of the points that Codavia makes. Doesn't matter if it's Republican, Democrat, right wing, left wing, that there's a ruling class that transcends those distinctions in American culture. And I think that's profoundly true. And that's the ruling class that we need to, that we will always be on the outside of, and we will always be outcasts in relationship to their values. Now, it has its manifestations in probably one political party more than another, and in some institutions more than another. But the fact of the matter is the ruling class is sort of monolithic in the values that it's espousing. So I assume that what you don't like is the idea of owning the name bigot, for example, or owning the name... Yeah. Okay. Well, okay. See, what you're saying is exactly right. What I owe to every human being, even my enemies, I'm not much of a follower of Jesus if I don't recognize that I owe them love. So in the way that I behave toward them and the way I act toward them, yes, you're absolutely right. Everybody, every human being on the planet is it's fit that I promote their well-being and their good. What James is talking about and what I'm talking about is an entirely different thing, and that is I need to understand the truth that there are fools out there who are children of the devil, and there are people who are gaining in wisdom, learning wisdom, who are children of God. There is that distinction in reality. And I have the same regard for them in terms of the love that I owe them, but I don't have the same regard for them in terms of whether they have the right to dictate their values to me. That's what I'm talking about. And I think that's what James is talking about.
Maybe it's just the manner that you're talking about it.
Maybe the
manner that you're talking about it. I don't know. That's good.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well, if there's a problem with the manner in which I do it, I didn't do it. It's sin dwelling within me.
I don't mean your manner. I mean if we were hateful and bigots and not open to anybody else's opinion.
Yeah. Well, no. See, I'm not denying that there are real bigots that are evil for their bigotry, and there are narrow-minded people who are evil in their narrow mind. I mean, all that stuff is true. But you see, that's how insidious it is. Because we all know that's true, we don't want to be called that. I mean, that would be morally outrageous to be a bigot or to be a chauvinist or to be narrow-minded. And we all know that that would be morally outrageous to be that. That's why it stings when someone accuses you of that. But that's what's so insidious, because... So let's take the most recent one. You Islamophobe. You know, what is that really? What that really is a way of disarming you from ever even drawing the distinction that Christianity is valid in a way that Islam is not. And if you ever even begin to approach making that point, they're gonna sling the term Islamophobe at you, which means a hater, a racist, a bigot, a chauvinist, a hater of people in that religion. Really? Is that what I am? Because I believe that Jesus really was the Christ sent from God to save Jews and Gentiles alike all over the world, and that if you miss out on that, you're missing out on eternal life. Just the fact that I believe that makes me a morally despicable, outrageous person. That's what they want me to believe. And do you see how powerful that is in shutting us up, in shaping, and ultimately over time, it even erodes our own conviction. So we get to a point where we start thinking, well, you know, Muhammad wasn't all that bad over time. Because I've got to go there to remain my own self-respect as an intelligent human being at the same time that I'm actually, in order to protect myself from social rejection, I'm backing off from what I actually believe is true. And as I back off from what I actually believe is true, I have to come up with reasons that justify my backing up from it, so I begin to transform what I actually believe. I am being conformed to the world. I'm letting the ruling class dictate to me what I will and will not believe. And of all the people in the world, what I'm saying, of all the people in the world, we who are believers in Jesus should be the ones who have the courage and the humility and the foresight to just tell it like it is. We have to have the humility to know I may not have everything right. I'm still learning. We must always have that humility. But we should have the forthrightness to say, as I see it, I don't think Muhammad was delivering the same message that Jesus was. Sorry, but I don't think that's true. And not be intimidated by our culture from saying anything differently than that. Not because we're going to change the world. I need to do that for my own sake. How am I going to keep clarity in my own head if I don't call truth, truth, and error, error, good, good, and evil, evil? Paul in Hebrews talks about through practice having our senses trained to discern good from bad. And I think he's talking about understanding there, good understanding from bad understanding. It takes practice. And if what we practice is dancing to the tune that other people are whistling, we're not getting the practice actually discerning for ourselves the difference between good and evil. So it's our souls that are at stake. It's our life that's at stake. It's our wisdom that's at stake. And we have to understand the dynamics that are at play and the forces that are impinging upon us and not ignore it. And the way we've dealt with this in the past, and if there's any exhortation in all of this, it's this. The way we've dealt with it in the past, and I've thought about it this way until the last probably several years now, is that choosing your political affiliation and your political ideology and the sort of political theories that you espouse is kind of like preferring jazz to country western. Well, that's a bad example. Country Western is of the devil. but it's kind of like liking your taste for ice cream or music. It's not a matter of right or wrong. It's not a matter of being obedient to Jesus or not. And I've come to realize we hide a lot of our softening and willingness to be conformed to the world under the grand assumption that, well, we all believe in Jesus. We all trust Jesus. We all belong to him. I just happen to have these political persuasions, and someone else just happens to have these others. Well, if the Calvinists are right, every thought needs to be made captive to Christ Jesus. All of our beliefs have to be brought into conformity with what Jesus came and gave us as the worldview that's actually true and objectively true. Then I mustn't ever rest. I mustn't ever stop and say, okay, this is just one among many options. It's okay. It's not. I need to have my beliefs line up with what's true. And now, that's what I said. What I said at the beginning, it's not a matter of whether it's not our salvation that's on the line. If we are children of God, we are children of God, no matter how messed up my understanding might be. And maybe my political views are completely and totally messed up, but I'm not trusting in them. I'm trusting in the mercy of my advocate, Jesus, and he's got my back. That's what I'm counting on. But as someone who has trusted in Jesus, I really do want to be on this journey where I'm learning to become clearer and clearer and clearer on who God is, who human beings are, what sin is, what the nature and dynamic of sin is, and what implications all that has for every area of my life, for art, for music, for economics, for politics, for medicine. Every area of my life needs to be subjected to the light of the truth of what Jesus came into the world to teach. So on that journey, I don't think we can't responsibly take the option of, well, it doesn't really matter. There's different Christians believe different things, and just they're all valid. It's all an option. I don't think so. And I've kept you way over time, and I need to let you go.